And I literally had to look in the mirror and go, okay, you have to stop resisting telling people that you're pretending you don't do TV and radio. You officially, right. And it was a Love Line at night on the radio. So I thought, you're officially doing television.
Right.
And it's okay.
What's up, guys? John Roa here. Welcome to Between Us, the new version of the John Roa Show podcast. When we last spoke, I told you this show was going to change and it was going to pivot. And this is kind of the start of that process. My goal with this podcast was to highlight the ability that I have to relate to incredibly successful people. And Between Us is exactly that. I want you to come along as my friend, sitting alongside me in a dark lounge with great cocktails, maybe a porch on a warm evening, or a kitchen table at the end of a party, when the ideas really come out, as I get the honest intimacy about what's behind the facade or the bravado created by a certain type of success from the other friends that I think you guys really should meet. To start off the new show, we're going to talk to one of the first doctors to hit the mainstream influencer level, the one and only Dr. Drew. You know him from his hit shows, Loveline and Celebrity Rehab, where he's helped others discover the hidden potential within themselves to overcome obstacles in their lives and relationships, which we'll get into. But today, we're going to discuss the battles that he's had behind the scenes. From Dr. Drew's start, his mother, which is a unique character in the story, set up the foundations of his mental and physical health. And I'm really grateful that he spoke openly and honestly about those hardships because it's what led him into medicine. However, boundaries are always a hurdle to deal with in self-discovery, and it makes things really difficult to find your voice. Dr. Drew had to overcome the cognitive dissonance that he had all of this medical knowledge that could help the world, but he was convinced that he wasn't the person to deliver it. He then somehow stumbled into the Wild West of the dot-com boom of the late 1990s. Dr. Drew had millions of dollars from venture capital firms that built him up and then took a hard turn, leading to public exposure to failure and controversy laid out before him. Dr. Drew had to make big choices about who he would be in this world, how he would reconcile Dr. Drew the celebrity with Dr. David Pinsky, the addiction specialist, both trying to do good in the world for those in need. Without further ado, here's Dr. Drew. I don't know if you've heard this before, but it feels like you're somebody we all know, but don't know, right? Because you're the one talking to people like me and everybody else in the world and putting on the show and projecting out, but we don't necessarily know that much about you. And well,
I think that's a phenomenon. It's gotten, that sort of thing has gotten worse and worse, even with the internet, which is that if you're a public figure, you're a cartoon character.
Yes.
That's how it's consumed. It's very weird. Nobody seems interested in there being a human being.
Right. And how does that make you feel as the human being?
Horrible. It's horrible. It's gotten worse and worse. It used to be people wanted to have a sort of a relationship. Now it's they want to have target practice or something.
That seems exactly like what it is. And you were very relevant in my formative years, you and Adam, in doing what you guys are doing. And so it's probably been, 20, 25 years that we've interacted with you, that people like me of my age, I'm my late 30s, we've interacted with you. And
I started in 1983.
That's the year I was born.
Do that math.
That's the year I was born. So let's start there. Who is Dr. David Drew Pinsky?
So I was raised in Pasadena. My dad is a family practitioner. My mom had a lot of psychopathology. She was a opera singer who always considered herself an opera singer, but ended up being a big band singer and then coming out here and being in B film noirs and sort of 50s television. And I found out in my 50s that she actually had a previous marriage to a silent film star. And he was the one that brought her out here when she was 18.
Wow.
Wife number five.
Ooh.
And antics ensued.
Wow.
And she managed to take that to her grave. I found out, and then I thought, this is important for her to know, for no one to know. Why should I out her?
It's like, wow,
whatever. And she was severely emotionally abusive to me. My dad was sort of good guy, unavailable, good physician, but busy, workaholic.
Yeah.
So I think as a result of that, I was always searching and sort of wasn't social functioning wasn't easy for me. Affect was unregulated. I had a lot of depression, anxiety, that sort of thing. In college, I started having severe panic attacks and real depression, and was thoroughly mismanaged, which is kind of what got me interested in mental health and particularly adolescent health, because I thought to myself, I don't want anybody ever to go through this. Right. And there's no one thinking about adolescents and their special needs. And then anyway, I was, you know, identity, I didn't know what I wanted to do, who I was, blah, 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 blah. And finally got back to sciences in my sophomore year of college, and was, my brain had developed to the point that I could actually compete, number one. So I really felt I could do the work that I needed to do to go on it and do medicine. But it also was thrilling to me at that point. I was really engaged, like over the top, like into it. And I remember when I, first year of medical school, when I remember after an anatomy lab in the afternoon, in the evening, I was going to, I had my car parked on the roof of this parking lot. I'd always go up there and just go, oh God, I'm so excited. I'm so happy I'm doing this. This is amazing. I'm so purposeful. And so that's where I kind of found my way. Never anticipated radio or any of these other things. I always enjoyed performing. I did a fair bit of it, you know, through my life, but didn't understand that I would integrate these two things in any kind of meaningful way.
Yeah. Is some of the performing because of what you mentioned about your mom and some of that kind of emotional disconnection?
Yeah.
Because you,
I suspect, I, you know, it's hard to be as objective about these things. I mean,
right.
That or it's genetic, it's in my system. I don't know what the
hell. Because you hear that a lot, right? And a lot of my friends that are in the arts and especially performing arts, it goes back to some kind of disconnect, right? That they needed to feel like they were performing to get attention or whatever that might be.
Yeah, I never had that kind of, I'm not aware of that so much as I think I got a little high from the performing.
Like right,
it was
some
rewarding. And now my favorite thing to do is public speaking. I mean, that's what I really enjoy doing now. So that's the, my present day version of that.
Yeah.
And what I like about it is it's a full integration of all my abilities.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's one of the goals of human experience is to integrate all the things we got.
Correct.
And then use those in a creative way. I think being creative is another iterative, restorative piece of sort of feeling like you have a meaningful life.
You had an interesting quote last year. You said, medicine saved my life quite literally, how much you love doing it. And because as much as you are a celebrity doctor, it's clear this comes from a voracious point of passion and of need for you to help people.
Yes. Yes. I'm almost gluttonous with that. And I've thought a lot about it because I do believe that meaningful life is dependent on service and on making a difference and service to other people. And the most efficacious way to nourish ourselves is to help one person at a time. I mean, that really, and I did lots of that. I still do lots of that. But this other part might, if as I think about it, it harkens back to my naive, I had a naive idea in 1983. I was just thinking, this is all easy for people to understand and no one just spends the time to kind of give it to them. And at the time, radio, I felt, was having a really negative effect on mental health in young people. I mean, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I thought, if it has that much of a negative impact, certainly we can just, I just had this image of turning a battleship. Like, certainly we can turn it and make it do something good, too. And that's kind of, that sort of imagery has stayed with me to this day. They'll let you know the battleship would be thinking or whatever it's doing now.
And that's my question, because you just said it was naive. So what was naive about that? Because you I'm sure you went into it with the right intention. So where was the naivete?
Well, the naivete was I didn't understand what I was embarking on at all. Just had a naive image, which was not inaccurate and not wrong. It was just naive. I didn't understand. I mean, if you had said in 1983, I remember somebody said something like that to me at one point. They went, I forget what the question was, but I remember the reaction I had was something like, you know, well, what are you going to be doing 10 years from now? And I thought to myself, well, not this. Radio in 10 years, that'd be weird. How could I still be doing it in 1993?
Right.
That'd be crazy. You know, and so I had no sense of where we were going or what this was all about.
Yeah. And that was obviously a different era where radio was it, right? I mean, that's where the voices were, the influence was. That's the social media today when it comes to influence was radio. So what did you experience in the 80s and 90s in terms of that influence, in terms of the surprises, the effect you had, and what it did to you as a person?
I don't know that there's much to that because okay. I was just sort of drifting along. You know, right. I wouldn't even say it felt like I had the tiger by the tail. I just felt like I had found a medium and a vehicle that was effective and fun. And let's just keep doing it. It was rewarding and it was interesting to me. And I would meet interesting people every time I went in there. And it certainly was a very different outlet from what I was doing during the day in the hospital.
Right.
And so I mean, it changed me in the sense that in 2010, I finally went, well, you understand, I was resistant to even admitting I was in the media, right? You understand? That's why I didn't use my real name. I didn't want anybody to think I was promoting myself. I just wanted to do this thing.
Right.
And this thing was radio and, you know, talk about these issues and HIV and AIDS. I was very, very, you know, passionate about. And the idea that it would take over again, I was always like, hey, just leave me alone to practice medicine. I'll come out and do these things. Even like, I remember Loveline TV, right? We did that on MTV. And they wanted to do it. I was like, well, you can have Friday afternoon and Saturday afternoon, and that's it. Otherwise, don't bother me, you know? And so we crammed it all into Friday afternoon.
Right.
I would work in the morning at the hospitals and go there in the afternoon, and we'd do six shows. We were, again, naive, didn't know that was a huge amount of television. We just change clothes, do another one, change clothes, do another one.
Is that
clothes,
right? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious. And where did the relationship with Adam start?
I was a fan of his character, Mr. Bertram, and I used to time my nursing home rounds. They gave him a shift on Saturday mornings, and I used to literally time my nursing home rounds on Saturday to be sure I was in the car during his breaks.
Oh, wow.
So I could hear, and he would take calls during those breaks, and I just thought it was very funny. And I'd had him on Loveline as a guest once as Mr. Bertram. and television producers showed up and said, we're going to make a TV show out of this radio show. And I'm like, how do you do that? What's a TV show? Well, sounds interesting. Let's go do that. I don't know. But I was broadcasting at the time with Ricky Rackman, and he couldn't make a deal with them. And they turned to me and said, you know, who do you want to, and I was like, I don't know anything about any of these things. Why do you guys just give me a co-host? I don't know what, you know, and I was running a couple of days later, and I could show you the spot I was. It just came to me. I went, God, that guy that does Bertram, I bet he has the sensibility.
Wow.
I bet he could do it. And we sort of screen tested. That was a Wednesday. They called us back on a Saturday. They put us in a makeup booth together and said, you guys work out your relationship. We're going to start filming in 2 hours.
That's unbelievable. And what year was that?
96, 95.
Okay. And so right after that, because you told me a remarkable story on your podcast that I want you to kind of repeat because it slots in perfectly for what I talk a lot about, which is entrepreneurship. So you got together with Adam, then only a couple of years later, I think you said it was 97 or 98.
Let me interrupt you. You said another thing that got my attention, I think. Maybe it was you, that entrepreneurs say yes to everything. Was that you?
I say that quite often. Yeah.
So it's only in the last year or so have I found myself not saying yes to everything.
Okay.
I would just say yes. I would just go, let's explore, whatever.
Right.
Yes, figure it out.
Yeah.
I mean, but everything, I would just say yes to it. When I look back on it, it's like, wow, how did I do that?
Right.
But that I think you sort of pointed that out, or I've heard you say it once or something. I thought that is a really interesting and important phenomenon. And you have to have the engine running to say yes to everything.
Absolutely.
It adds up. You're saying yes to everything, all of a sudden you're doing A lot of things. I just did. I said yes to everything.
Well, and the thing you said yes to a couple of years later, which is the story that I want you to recreate for us, is the drdrew.com, your foray into venture capital and being a tech entrepreneur during the first tech boom, which is one of the craziest stories.
I told the whole story when we were together because I realized I'd never told it to. I was really telling it to Gary,
who's
the producer. Drew.com, a Dr. Drew podcast.
Yeah.
So it's 1998 or something, 1999. And my friend who I went to seventh grade with, college, he went to Harvard Business School, and he came around and he goes, let's build a website. This was during the .com craze, right? And he's like, you could do this. I'm like, do what? What's a website? How would this work? He goes, look, just follow my lead. I think we can get this done. And so he found some seed capital. I actually wasn't even involved with that. I don't even know how he did that.
Right.
And I remember the first thing, they took me out to Orange County and to meet with this organization that gave us, I think they gave us $1 million. And I thought this, I had no business training really. And I was like, $1 million? Who are these people? Yeah. They pull $1 million from the air and give it to us. Weird. And still didn't know. And still, I was the one they wanted to talk to about the vision for this thing that I didn't understand. First thing about, I mean, I didn't know what a website was. I didn't have email at the time. I mean, I had zero in relationship with the computer.
Yeah, not a website, but your website, drdrew.com is the project that you're out there pitching, right?
That's what we're going to go make.
Yeah.
And this is back to saying yes to everything. and my friend was always there holding my hand and shaping things and answering questions, very appropriate marketing kinds of terms that I didn't fully understand. And so we went out and, I can't remember the first hires we had. I remember the first computers we bought because I thought, what? You just buy computers? how do you do that?
Right.
And we started work. Let me see. Did he hire a tech? He must have hired a tech person to start building it. And if he took that $1 million, he started putting something together and he just started putting it together. I wasn't involved in these early stages. But the next thing I know, he's asking me to come up to San Jose. I'm really not very involved in the early stages. It was just sort of phone conversations here and there and still not fully understanding where this was going to go or what this was. But I was certainly hearing about what was going on in the world at the time, right? Because it was very pressworthy, you know, what was going on in Silicon Valley and, you know, the dot-com bubble and not bubble yet. We were just the dot-com craze at that point.
The boom.
It was called a craze or boom at that point. And he takes me to Sand Hill Road and we meet with a SoftBank company. Oh, Christ, what was it? I can't remember the name of the company, but there was about 8 people in a conference room. And my buddy just says, follow my lead. Literally, we do no problem. Just follow my lead. And he kind of presents to them and they look to me and go, you know, what do you see this thing being? And I don't even remember what I said. I just sort of talked about reaching people and making a difference. Same stuff we were talking about 10 minutes ago, you know, using media to make a difference. And I just sort of talked about my passion for that kind of stuff. And they go, hang on a second. And they all filed out of the room. And I remember I could see them. They were in another conference room across the way. Might have been an office, but everything had full glass. There was just glass everywhere. And you could just see what they were doing. And they seemed to be in heated conversation for maybe... It felt like 5 minutes. It was maybe 10 minutes.
Right.
And they came back and they went, okay, it's a go. And I did not know what that even meant. I didn't know what go was. I didn't know what venture. These were venture capital guys. I didn't know what venture capital was. I didn't know nothing. They gave us $10 million. And my buddy put a board together and the board was with all kinds of people from, you know, important people from Sand Hill Road as well. And the story I told you was, We started putting the company together. Now we have a marketing department, we have a tech department, we have a content department, and we were essentially creating a phone book online and another magazine, online magazine. And I kept saying, why do we need all this? Why do you need this same material that you get in a magazine on a computer? We need to have video. We need to have something interactive. Yeah. And the interactive piece we got, we had chat rooms and things, and we had people doing special online kinds of appearances and, you know, we had experts coming in and stuff, but it really was not, people were not really engaged with that kind of thing yet. And we did film a television show every week with, I mean, we still have some of the footage from that stuff. I mean, everybody wanted to be on it. It was all the Loveline guests.
You got to post that sometime. That would be fantastic to read.
Occasionally. We do. It was, you know, Blink 182 and Electra and Dave Navarro and all these, you know, the usual suspects.
Yeah.
Nobody could watch this show, which was very high quality show. Because nobody had broadband.
That's right.
So we had outstripped the technical ability to actually deliver the thing that would have made the difference. The thing we could have been YouTube. I mean, it really was what we were doing. But anyway, my instinct was right. But I went to the first board meeting and, you know, all these guys are around the table and they go, what's the plan? I go, well, you know, I'm really trying to figure out how we make this thing profitable. It seems like because we're making no money, we were burning capital.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe we keep it small until we can get some profitability and then grow it out. And this one guy slammed his fist down and goes, if I had known you were going to be so stupid, I never would agree to be on this board. And he gets up to this huge dry erase board and he goes, I'm going to tell you how this has to be done and how you make money on the internet. And he doesn't say anything, but he writes in giant letters, like 6-foot letters, get big fast.
Yep.
And then he went on to talk about, you know, analytics and all the things we all now know about, which I'd never heard of, and how to, you know, how to grow an audience and interaction, all this stuff. And I thought, as he's standing there doing it, I thought to myself, well, that's that. That's how we're going to do this. We're not going to make any money. We're going to burn through this $10 million.
Yeah.
Which we did. We had 120 employees. We had a little nirvana. It was really high quality people. We were creating high quality content. It was really good.
Yeah.
And we had this TV show and stuff. It was wonderful. And then we started running out of money. And by the way, the Sand Hill Road guys were, their only sort of direction was, you're not burning money fast enough.
Right. Yeah.
This was bizarre. I was like, what?
And this is still how it goes. Yes. This hasn't changed, by the way.
That's the weird. I cannot. It's like incredible. Anyway, so not burning money fast enough was basically the cry.
Yeah.
My buddy and I, his name is Curtis Giesen. He's a, if it maybe helps him, he's still doing wonderful internet ventures all over the place. And he has something called Dashboard Ventures. And he took me to New York. And he said, we need to raise more money. And I'm like, well, whatever. Now I'm kind of, I'm still in sort of a fog, but things are, I'm seeing and recognizing certain things about what we're doing. I'm at least going to look back and understand what we've done. Let's put it that way. And he goes, we're going to meet at Goldman Sachs. And he goes, do you understand Goldman Sachs? This is like the Super Bowl. We're going to go to Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
And we went in there. We made our pitch. We had a $120 million valuation.
Oh my God.
They were going to give us $30 million or something on a company that didn't make a penny and had no plan to make a penny. And I remember, and that was March 19th, 1999, the day the NASDAQ collapsed, literally the day. So we're sitting across the table from this woman who's going, yeah, I think this, we're interested in this, but let's see how the market plays out today. I think we need to see where this goes, where the NASDAQ's going today. And my buddy and I literally went to Times Square and we were looking in through that, you know, that big NASDAQ building. Well, there's inside there, if you look in through the big glass windows, is a giant graph of the NASDAQ performance. And we were literally watching the thing that day just go to the top through the floor. And we were like, oh, this, no way. They're not going to give it to us. And they didn't. And then we ran out of money. And then I learned about how you downsize a company and then how you liquidate a company.
That's right.
So I got education on an entire business cycle from seed to liquidation. And I'm going to tell you something. I learned a ton.
Yep.
A ton.
It's a hell of a lesson. Now, does that kind of experience, when you've been through that and then you read a story or watch a documentary about like a Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, are you kind of like, okay, I can see how that goes now? Can you kind of relate to these insane business stories you hear today because of what you experienced?
Yes, I can. I can for many of the more technical or sort of obscure. Yeah, let's put it this way. When I watch Silicon Valley, I know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
It's compressed, but it's accurate. I go, I can look at that and go, that is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Everything there is 100% accurate.
Yeah.
It's not accurate in terms of some of the overtop characters and some of the time compression is a little off, but it's the phenomenon, exactly what I experienced.
Exactly.
But Theranos, see, I had trouble with that because it offended my biological sensibilities.
Of course.
So offensive to me biologically. And I was so not in that I was like, where's the biologist? Where are the doctors straightening these people out?
Yeah.
And that's, I couldn't get past that. So the story made no sense to me from the beginning.
And that's what a lot of medical professionals have said. Yet there were medical professionals on the board in the company that allowed this all to happen. And
well, now that I understand.
Yeah.
Because they get a load of shit from the CEO or the management about what they're going to do. Right. And you, as somebody who wants to be supportive and is being given what they're being told is this great opportunity, it's really a cognitive distortion. You
start absolutely going,
okay, I see how they could, maybe this is how they could make it work. Well, there's the smart people. They're telling me it's a persuasion problem.
Yes.
You buy in. And once you buy in, you start I definitely see how that can happen. You start like, how was it Cyrus Vance and guys like smart guys were in this thing because they're thinking, oh, these are smart people. These are young people. They're going to figure out something. I don't see it here, but they keep telling me they're going to go somewhere. Maybe I can help them get there. Yep. I could easily see how somebody could think that way.
Yeah, but more like just the excessive, you know, capital fundraising that the tell them to spend as much as you possibly can to get to these goals. I mean, that's still how it goes. It is wild. And that is still Silicon Valley to this day.
And that's just because a couple of them make it. You know what I mean? Because if you make it, the upside is so high that it's worth throwing money at that. Is that how
sometimes, or you know, because if you can dig out a deep enough, you know, trench, then no one else can ever get to your size to compete, and then you can turn on the profitability. That's like an Amazon play, right? I mean, they were not profitable for the first 19 of 20 years or whatever, you know, but they got to a size where no one could compete, and then you turn on the you know, some methods of becoming profitable. And that's kind of the mindset. And then everyone else who loses the billions along the way, there's going to be one big winner. So let's talk about the next 20 years. So we went through your Silicon Valley roller coaster. We're now in the 2000s. And your whole game changed a lot after that, it seems like to me, from kind of reading the trajectory of where you went. So tell us about the 2000s for Dr. Drew.
I the beginning of the 2000s, I just went back to practicing medicine. I was just because I remember everything sort of went away all at once. MTV ended, the business fell apart. And I'm like, well, that's that. I'm go back to my business. And I found myself, because I was working more and more in addiction medicine at the time, I found myself being asked to do more commentary in the news and stuff about it. So I was doing a lot of CNN. I found myself running around doing commentary because there was more buzz in the air about addiction and celebrities and addiction. And this, it was just more in the conversation.
Right.
And so that was my expertise. I mean, I was doing all that. By then I'd assembled the team I wanted, the addiction team I wanted, because all the while I've been running this addiction program since 1991 is when I started. And God, I can't believe it was that long. And it took a while to get it into shape where it was really a high quality program. And we were there in 2000. We were really, we had the reputation for being able to take care of the sickest addicts. When everybody else couldn't handle them, we got them.
Yeah.
Medical, psychiatric, addiction, withdrawal, you name it, we could handle it. And I always said we can handle any case provided they don't need a ventilator. Otherwise, we got them. We got them. And a lot of those were celebrities, and we treated a lot of celebrity in those days that no one knows to this day because, you know, we were very confidential about what we did.
Sure.
And I don't think I did much else for about five, six years. And then these, again, TV producers show up and they go, we're going to do a show about, we want you to do this thing. And I'm like, what? How do you, it's impossible. You can't do that. And they, we're going to do it. I'm like, okay. And I literally thought to myself, you don't know this part of the story either. I thought, well, I haven't done anything in 4 or 5 years. It's good to go out there and pitch and get in front of the executives. Maybe I'll figure something I can do. I don't know. It's again, the more that yes, saying yes. Exactly. I was just saying yes.
Yeah.
Go out and see it. I didn't think it was remotely possible that this would be a TV show. And I went around and it was a lot of no. And I was like, yeah, of course. And then all of a sudden VH1 showed interest. And I was like, oh shit, you got to be kidding me. So I went into hiding. I actually was like, I was not returning phone calls and stuff because I didn't think this was, I don't know. I wasn't super comfortable with it. And all of a sudden one day, Bob Forrest, you know, got the glasses and the hat. And we worked together all, you know, for years. We were friends back when he was a drug addict. And then I ended up cutting ties with him and telling everybody he had to go because he's going to die. That's it. He's going to die. There's nothing we can do. And so let's mourn the loss of Bob Forrest and get on with our lives.
Wow.
Literally, that's what I coached everybody up. And that was it with Bob. 15 years later, I was giving a lecture to a group of drug addicts. And there was a guy in the front row who looked like Bob Forrest and was asking me these amazing questions. And the whole time, I have a whole dialogue with myself. I'm thinking, oh, my God, the guy looks like Bob Forrest. Well, can't be Bob Forrest. He's dead. And he came up to me after the lecture and goes, hey, man, you know, we used to know each other. I was like, holy shit, I can't believe it. But I could see the talent. And I was like, what are you doing now? What are you up to?
Wow.
In touch. And I followed him and watched what he was doing and had a lot of contact with him and stole him, put him in my program and built him into Bob Forrest. And
unreal.
Anyway, he came in my office and we had this little office and I would sit in a chair like this. And we had a sort of a patient chair, which is a big kind of cushier chair. And he sat in the patient chair and he goes, you know, I am so tired about our patient, how our patients are being portrayed in the press. They're being portrayed like they're making excuses for being, then that treatment is somehow an excuse, or that they're on a vacation, or that this is a spa treatment. He goes, we need to do a TV show. We show how sick they are, how hard they work, how difficult this is. And I was stunned. I thought for a second, did somebody send you in to talk to me? Yeah. And I go, Bob, it may surprise you, but somebody's actually talking to me about doing something like this. And he goes, we have to do this. We must do it. And I go, all right, man, if that's your instinct, I'm going to go forward. Wow. I'll never forget. He slapped his hands on his knees and jumped up and he goes, yes. And he walked out of the room. And I thought, all right, I'll call the producers, and they're wanting to have another meeting at VH1. I'll go have that meeting. And still, I had no idea how they were going to do this, because I kept telling them, you can't go to a hospital with cameras. Even if you come near a hospital with a camera and somebody goes, that camera made me want to kill myself, you're liable. Yeah. That's as close as a camera can get to a psychiatric hospital.
Right.
This is an interesting sort of entrepreneurial point too, we haven't talked about, which is problem solving. You know, so just going, I really learned through Celebrity Rehab. I had an excellent executive producer, a guy named John Irwin, and he just kept saying, we'll figure it out.
Yep.
And I kept going, really? I don't think so, but okay, I'll try. I'll keep going. And God damn it, we figured it out. I thought, oh, you know what, that Dr. Bloom runs a residential program. Residential programs have entirely different HIPAA, you know, privacy requirements. And I bet I could take my team and take like one of his wards and just insert my team there and do our work. That was it.
Wow.
Now there were many other obstacles with that show. The 2 days before we started filming, we found out it wasn't licensed for me to do the work I needed to do with the patients. Like I couldn't do one-on-ones and I couldn't do groups.
Okay.
So literally now we're like, oh my God, well, there's a church across the street. You can do the group church. And what they did was they built a double wide in the parking lot, and that double wide had a separate address that was licensed for me. And that in that address, I could do groups and one-on-one therapy and all in medical assessments and stuff. And so what you don't see is that when the patients leave the unit, which is a real unit, they walk outside, they walk across a parking lot. And when they walk into the room for group, they're walking into a trailer.
Unbelievable. I mean, and you are speaking to the entrepreneur's hustle there, right? Because that's what we do all day. We take seemingly impossible paths and we navigate them. And that's the entrepreneur's, you know, battle that we do every day.
And it's time limited too, which I think is an important piece.
Absolutely.
Right? You're under the gun. It's like, let's figure it out, but we're filming in 2 days.
Yeah. And so how long did Celebrity Rehab run? I can't recall when that ran its course.
We did like it was about 5 years.
Yeah.
We did several incarnations, right? We did sex rehabs. We did a sex addiction show. We did rehab of regular people. So one of the criticisms we got was, why don't you treat regular people, which I do all the time. And I said, fine, let's do that. And nobody watched that. So that was the end of that model.
Does that make you sad that we care this much about celebrities?
Yeah, particularly then. Yeah, it was weird. I wouldn't have predicted that. I think we did 5 or 6 seasons with celebrities, and then what we do, sex addiction, regular rehab. I think that's all we did. But so we did like about 8 or 9 shows with that. It was intense, man. It was super, super, super intense. And so on the heels of that, you're talking about the 2000s, 2010 rolls around, and now HLN hires me for a daily show and CW hires me for a daily morning talk show. And I literally had to look in the mirror and go, okay, you have to stop resisting telling people that you're pretending you don't do TV and radio. You officially, and it was a love line at night on the radio. So I like, you're officially doing television.
Right.
And it's okay. You've done 35 years of medicine. You've done it full time. You can now do that part time and go explore this other thing you've been doing, but do it for real. They're like, do it like it's a job. Not like you're pretending that it's a job. Right,
moonlighting, yeah.
Yeah, and so I thought, okay, officially I'm in television. And that was 2010. And so since then, I've been focusing more specifically. I stopped doing the addiction treatment program. I don't run that anymore. I stopped doing inpatient medicine. I just do small outpatient practice, and that's it. And everything else is everything else.
these almost battling iterations, right, of kind of Dr. David Pinsky and Dr. Drew are two seemingly different personas that you've managed for decades.
Well, you're so funny. I had a lot of psychotherapy because of all the emotional abuse when I was a kid. And it was very, very effective. But I remember I couldn't have done all this stuff, by the way, without therapy, because I was so perfectionistic about being a doctor. I couldn't allocate. I couldn't say no to anything. It was really bad. And I remember about 5 years into therapy, my therapist looked at me and she goes, "Maybe this is it for Dr. Pinsky, and it's time for Dr. Drew to emerge." And, wow. And I'll just never forget that moment. I thought that, oh, she's right. Mm. Dr. Pinsky is one thing and Dr. Drew is a different thing. And maybe it needs an opportunity to grow here.
Right. But that has to be a pretty difficult battle, because the celebrity Dr. Drew has got to be a very difficult role for you personally, right? I mean,
and remember, I was perfectionistic.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
I guarded my reputation highly.
Right.
And it was like a life or death importance to me to be that good, excellent physician. Since I made the transition in 2010, I've been much more able to take the onslaught.
Yeah.
Because my selfhood is not as tied into my physician selfhood.
Okay. So that separation, because that's what I was saying, because now your reputation's up to social media's backlash and it's up to whatever some jackass wants to say about you any given time. So
I would have found that intolerable in 19.
Yeah.
In 2005, I remember when Amazon book reviews were first available online.
Yeah.
And Adam and I put a book out, and I couldn't stand the negative reviews. I'd have to go on and answer. It was just mind boggling to me. People could say these things.
That's what I'm experiencing right now. My book came out 48 hours ago. And so I am in that exact mode right now. And it's hard. And I've been in it in different ancillary ways throughout my entrepreneurial life, but never this publicly with a memoir, et cetera. I can't imagine doing it at the level that you have for as long as you have. I mean, it just sounds,
it's still bad and awful when it goes bad, but you develop some resiliency.
Yeah.
It's a really kind of and I have found the last couple of shit storms I've been through that some of that resiliency is built on the experience of knowing who you are and what you are and what your intentions are, and just keep moving forward.
Yeah.
In other words, if something about me had been unearthed that I really felt ashamed of or bad about, or I'd really done something awful, I guess I would, that would be it. But when I know that it's just a shitstorm based on perception and manipulation and the usual stuff that garners. I saw in this social media Netflix thing yesterday, they were saying that fake news has 7 times the reach of real news. And that stayed with me. I thought that makes sense, because every time something kind of distorted and false comes out about me, that's the one that's the shitstorm. Well, and so I know that, and I just keep moving forward with what I feel to be good work.
Yeah.
We'll see where it emerges.
It can't be easy. And I'm so impressed by guys like you and people that are in my life. Like a great example of this is Sean McVay, who's the coach of the LA Rams out there. And he's one of my closest friends. And, you know, I watched his journey into, I met him kind of right when he started the NFL. So youngest head coach of all time, you know, and everyone's going, who the hell is this guy? And how dumb are the Rams for taking a bet on a 29-year-old kid with no experience as a head coach, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And he crushes his first season, and he is now a god, a future Hall of Famer, the best ever. The entire league changes their coaching strategy because of this kid. The next year, goes to the Super Bowl and loses. The next year, misses the playoffs. Now he's a fraud. Now he's a fake. And I speak to him a lot about this. I'm like, I don't know how you endure that, because 20 years ago, might have been a tabloid, or it might have been somebody on some random, you know, but now anyone with an opinion can blast that opinion out to as many people that care to view it, who then just recycle it and recycle it and recycle it until it almost cannot be avoided. And that just seems, for someone like you and him, who are truly public figures, to be one of the most challenging things I can think of in our kind of social media world today.
What does he say? Same thing. Is he similar to what I was just saying? Or?
It is similar. Yeah. I mean, sure. he has just such, you know, well, he's naturally just a resilient and tough guy, but he also just has, he knows who he is and he's done a lot of work to identify.
That's what I, you know, I'm a Rams fan and I'm here in Los Angeles. And that's what how I experience him. Like this guy knows what he knows.
He
you know
does.
What I mean? It's like, I feel like he knows what he knows. He knows something. He's got a plan.
Yeah.
It seems like it's a pretty good one. And I'm behind him.
Yeah, right? He's not immune to it. You know, it's no one's immune to it, as you've already acknowledged. But I am so that's why I'm just so impressed by people like you and him who have, you know, built that fortitude and that resilience inside yourselves to rise above that. Because again, I'm experiencing it at a much lesser level at the moment, and it's fucking hard, man. It's hard.
But learn from that piece of him that I respond.
Yeah,
is, you know what you know. You know what you did this.
Yeah,
you know what you're. You know, their perception is their perception, but you know something and you know what you're trying to do. Go forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a journey. And especially in a year like this, and this is something I want to hear from you on is, you know, mental health in this country has been a huge issue for, you know, increasingly in the last number of decades. And now 2020 has kind of just put like this capstone on a level that I'm not even sure people could ever have imagined in terms of just how bad it is and getting. What is your perception of kind of where we're at from a mental health perspective in this country right now and kind of how we can move forward in any kind of positive way?
The moving forward is a little challenging, but the where are we part is right now all roads lead to narcissism essentially.
Mm.
And this is all of us. All of us have some of these traits, and it's largely because of sort of families have not been functioning very well. There's been a lot of childhood trauma back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I remember, you know, when I first started working at a psychiatric hospital in 1983, there's a form that gets filled out on every patient's chart. It's the diagnosis, the axes, it was called back then, the axes. And axis two is the personality disorders. And back then, I remember there was all sorts of personality disorders, you know, dependent personalities and obsessive compulsive, you know, and then around 1988, I noticed it all suddenly, everybody had a cluster B disorder, which is the borderline sociopath, narcissist, that cluster B. And it's not changed since. And then I wrote some books about this, about, you know, what I was observing. And we actually went out and tested celebrities because I could see they had really severe narcissism. And we were able to prove that becoming a celebrity, our model showed that was a bid to deal with their narcissistic injuries. They did injuries in childhood, and celebrity was going to solve that. And of course, it doesn't.
Right.
So there's this, you know, it's much like my own journey with emotional abuse and all this stuff. This is really common stuff these days. And we end up with dysregulation and seeking ways to regulate ourselves. And we look to the society for ways to regulate. And that's money and drugs and, you know, extreme activities, you know, things that arouse, which make you feel better in the moment and then leave you just as bad as you were before.
Yep.
And so, and we've lost our sense of what really builds nourishment, which is interpersonal relations. And like we discussed half hour ago, service individually, one person to another, and having a skill set that helps you really help another person is extremely rewarding. But relationships are really the source of how, and that's in the zeitgeist now. People are talking about that.
Yeah.
We're sort of acknowledging it, but we aren't there with it. We're talking about it, but we aren't there with it. And the problem now is that we've gone so far into gratifying the pathological aspects. Fast foods are where we go, as opposed to, and you know, Oreos and Ho-Hos.
Yep.
As opposed to, you know, lean meats and exercise. Everything is gratifying the wrong and full, you know, pushing us in the wrong direction. Everything, whether it's our diet or our allowance of drug addiction or our inability to access and treat psychiatric problems, it's all not just allowing these things to run unchecked, but rocket fuel into
them.
Make sure they go. And we have got to start changing our laws, and we have to change how we approach people with these things. And hard work is what's required. We're going to take you and we're going to do this hard work. We're going to do the hard work of helping you get better. And the hard work, and the answer is not in a pill. Pill may help a little bit, but we're going to have to also do some hard work and get you some vocational rehab. It's not easy.
Yeah.
You can't just give people things and expect things. this is part of the problem. Things are too easy and accessible.
Yep.
And, you know, and you know, I don't, this, I love Grubhub, but let me just say, Grubhub is part of the problem. Things just appear.
Yep.
We, you know, we want a taco, the taco appears. Money doesn't really exist anymore. It just sort of Grubhub exists.
Yep.
No, people don't understand that somebody had to make the money to pay for the taco. It's all that's gone. And so, you know, hard work, exercise, relationships, all that basic stuff's got to come back in, but we have to have the structure in place to enforce those things.
What the hell do we do then? Because it seems like all these things are highly acknowledged, but going the absolute opposite direction, like rapidly.
I would not have said this a couple of years ago. We got to start with the healthcare system. We got to get an army of psychologists and psychiatrists out there, but we are helpless as mental health professionals.
Wow.
We need to change the laws. We need to change the people that are creating this social circumstances that is allowing people to die in the streets. We're losing 4 a day in Los Angeles. That's murder. Wow. That's murder. These are murderers.
Yeah.
These people cannot run a government. This is not a society anymore. I think we need a new party called the Pragmatic Party.
And right.
What do we do to make things better for human beings?
Right.
Please. That's all. This is not working. This is not going in the right direction. And it's because of these laws and policies that are just, and I hate the word permissive. It's not even that. It's irrational. They're irrational. They're anathema to what people need. And let's do what people need and give them that.
Yeah.
It's hard work. I'm sorry. It's hard work.
It's very hard work. And it's something, you know, I've been feeling a lot more because I've had to be super present with the book and the podcast and super on. I committed to turn my phone off for the next 3 days over the weekend. Aside to call my niece for her birthday tomorrow. I'm going to go offline. I think we do more of that because I'm starting to feel that pressure that I feel must be very present in lives like yours. And it's like, this is not an easy time to be on and be present and trying to be active in this insane world we're in.
Yeah. I mean, you got to remember, I am seasoned at this. You're a newbie and it's very painful.
It's very painful.
And it doesn't bother me so much right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have to be objective and just do it and stay focused on what I want to do and put good information out. Yeah. Try not to step on any landmines. But, you know,
yeah.
Best I can. That's
sure.
It. I just do the best I can.
Yeah.
That's all. I go with a clear heart and hopefully I will help somebody along the way. That'd be great.
Yeah. Well, you have, and it's obvious how much you care. The conversation, the story is incredibly inspiring and interesting. And your time is valuable. I appreciate you sharing it with me and with us. Dr. Drew, you're awesome. Thank you for that conversation.
Yeah, John, I really enjoy it. We've now spent 2 hours together and it's both are really enjoyable. So I hope to see you more when I get out to the city.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Drew.
All right, man. Talk soon.
Thanks again to Dr. Drew for joining today. I really hope you enjoyed the show today and our new show structure. I'd love to hear from you, so you can find me on social media at John Roa, JohnRoa, and roa.com. My memoir, A Practical Way to Get Rich and Die Trying, is now out at all major booksellers, online and in person. A big thanks to Maddie Stout and the team at Jam Street Media. This episode was produced by Casey Franco and Amanda Rosenberg. We'll see you next week.